Anyone looking to preserve a body needed to get ahead of those enzymes before the tissues began to rot. Neurons die quickly, so brains were a lost cause to ancient Egyptian mummifiers, which is why, according to Greek historian Herodotus, they started the process by hammering a spike into the skull, mashing up the brain, flushing it out the nose, and pouring tree resins into the skull to prevent further decomposition. Brains may decay first, but decaying guts are much worse. The liver, stomach, and intestines contain digestive enzymes and bacteria, which, upon death, start eating the corpse from the inside. So the priests removed the lungs and abdominal organs first. It was difficult to remove the lungs without damaging the heart, but because the heart was believed to be the seat of the soul, they treated it with special care. They placed the visceral organs in jars filled with a naturally occurring salt called natron. Like any salt, natron can prevent decay by killing bacteria and preventing the body's natural digestive enzymes from working. But natron isn't just any salt. It's mainly a mixture of two alkaline salts, soda ash and baking soda. Alkaline salts are especially deadly to bacteria, and they can turn fatty membranes into a hard, soapy substance, thereby maintaining the corpse's structure. After dealing with the internal organs, the priests stuffed the body cavity with sacks of more natron and washed it clean to disinfect the skin. Then, the corpse was set in a bed of still more natron for about 35 days to preserve its outer flesh. By the time of its removal, the alkaline salts had sucked the fluid from the body and formed hard brown clumps. The corpse wasn't putrid, but it didn't exactly smell good either. So priests poured tree resin over the body to seal it, massaged it with a waxy mixture that included cedar oil, and then wrapped it in linen. Finally, they placed the mummy in a series of nested coffins, and sometimes even a stone sarcophagus. So how successful were the ancient Egyptians at evading decay? On one hand, mummies are definitely not intact human bodies. Their brains have been mashed up and flushed out. Their organs have been removed and salted like salami. And about half of their remaining body mass has been drained away. Still, what remains is amazingly well preserved. Even after thousands of years, scientists can perform autopsies on mummies to determine their causes of death, and possibly even isolate DNA samples. This has given us new information. For example, it seems that air pollution was a serious problem in ancient Egypt, probably because of indoor fires used to bake bread. Cardiovascular disease was also common, as was tuberculosis. So ancient Egyptians were somewhat successful in evading decay. Still, like death, taxes are inevitable. When some mummies were transported, they were taxed as salted fish.
Sorry, my phone died. It's nothing. I'm fine. These allegations are completely unfounded. The company was not aware of any wrongdoing. I love you. We hear anywhere from 10 to 200 lies a day, and we spent much of our history coming up with ways to detect them, from medieval torture devices to polygraphs, blood pressure and breathing monitors, voice stress analyzers, eye trackers, infrared brain scanners, and even the 400-pound electroencephalogram. But although such tools have worked under certain circumstances, most can be fooled with enough preparation, and none are considered reliable enough to even be admissible in court. But what if the problem is not with the techniques, but the underlying assumption that lying spurs physiological changes? What if we took a more direct approach, using communication science to analyze the lies themselves? On a psychological level, we lie partly to paint a better picture of ourselves, connecting our fantasies to the person we wish we were rather than the person we are. But while our brain is busy dreaming, it's letting plenty of signals slip by. Our conscious mind only controls about 5% of our cognitive function, including communication, while the other 95% occurs beyond our awareness. And according to the literature on reality monitoring, stories based on imagined experiences are qualitatively different from those based on real experiences. This suggests that creating a false story about a personal topic takes work and results in a different pattern of language use. A technology known as linguistic text analysis has helped to identify four such common patterns in the subconscious language of deception. First, liars reference themselves less when making deceptive statements. They write or talk more about others, often using the third person to distance and disassociate themselves from their lie. Which sounds more false? Absolutely no party took place at this house, or I didn't host a party here. Second, liars tend to be more negative, because on a subconscious level, they feel guilty about lying. For example, a liar might say something like, "Sorry, my stupid phone battery died. I hate that thing." Third, liars typically explain events in simple terms, since our brains struggle to build a complex lie. Judgment and evaluation are complex things for our brains to compute. As a U.S. president once famously insisted, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman." And finally, even though liars keep descriptions simple, they tend to use longer and more convoluted sentence structure, inserting unnecessary words and irrelevant but factual-sounding details in order to pad the lie. Another president confronted with a scandal proclaimed, "I can say categorically that this investigation indicates that no one on the White House staff, no one in this administration presently employed, was involved in this very bizarre incident." Let's apply linguistic analysis to some famous examples. Take 7-time Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong. When comparing a 2005 interview in which he had denied taking performance-enhancing drugs to a 2013 interview in which he admitted it, his use of personal pronouns increased by nearly 3/4. Note the contrast between the following two quotes. First, "Okay, you know, a guy in a French, in a Parisian laboratory opens up your sample, you know, Jean-Francis so-and-so, and he tests it. And then you get a phone call from a newspaper that says we found you to be positive 6 times for EPO. Second, I lost myself in all of that. I'm sure there would be other people that couldn't handle it, but I certainly couldn't handle it, and I was used to controlling everything in my life. I controlled every outcome in my life." In his denial, Armstrong described a hypothetical situation focused on someone else, removing himself from the situation entirely. In his admission, he owns his statements, delving into his personal emotions and motivations. But the use of personal pronouns is just one indicator of deception. Let's look at another example from former senator and U.S. presidential candidate John Edwards. "I only know that the apparent father has said publicly that he is the father of the baby. I also have not been engaged in any activity of any description that requested, agreed to, or supported payments of any kind to the woman or to the apparent father of the baby." Not only is that a pretty long-winded way to say, "the baby isn't mine," but Edwards never calls the other parties by name, instead saying, "that baby, the woman, and the apparent father." Now let's see what he had to say when later admitting paternity. "I am Quinn's father. I will do everything in my power to provide her with the love and support she deserves." The statement is short and direct, calling the child by name and addressing his role in her life. So how can you apply these lie-spotting techniques to your life? First, remember that many of the lies we encounter on a daily basis are far less serious than these examples, and may even be harmless. But it's still worthwhile to be aware of telltale clues like minimal self-references, negative language, simple explanations, and convoluted phrasing. It just might help you avoid an overvalued stock, an ineffective product, or even a terrible relationship.
Imagine an island where 100 people, all perfect logicians, are imprisoned by a mad dictator. There's no escape except for one strange rule. Any prisoner can approach the guards at night and ask to leave. If they have green eyes, they'll be released. If not, they'll be tossed into the volcano. As it happens, all 100 prisoners have green eyes, but they've lived there since birth, and the dictator has ensured they can't learn their own eye color. There are no reflective surfaces. All water is in opaque containers. And most importantly, they're not allowed to communicate among themselves, though they do see each other during each morning's head count. Nevertheless, They all know no one would ever risk trying to leave without absolute certainty of success. After much pressure from human rights groups, the dictator reluctantly agrees to let you visit the island and speak to the prisoners under the following conditions. You may only make one statement, and you cannot tell them any new information. What can you say to help free the prisoners without incurring the dictator's wrath? After thinking long and hard, you tell the crowd, "At least one of you has green eyes." The dictator is suspicious, but reassures himself that your statement couldn't have changed anything. You leave, and life on the island seems to go on as before. But on the 100th morning after your visit, all the prisoners are gone, each having asked to leave the previous night. So how did you outsmart the dictator? It might help to realize that the amount of prisoners is arbitrary. Let's simplify things by imagining just two, Adria and Bill. Each sees one person with green eyes, and for all they know, that could be the only one. For the first night, each stays put. But when they see each other still there in the morning, they gain new information. Adria realizes that if Bill had seen a non-green-eyed person next to him, he would have left the first night, after concluding the statement could only refer to himself. Bill simultaneously realizes the same thing about Adria. The fact that the other person waited tells each prisoner his or her own eyes must be green. And on the second morning, they're both gone. Now imagine a third prisoner. Adria, Bill, and Carl each see two green-eyed people, but aren't sure if each of the others is also seeing two green-eyed people, or just one. They wait out the first night as before, but the next morning, they still can't be sure. Carl thinks, if I have non-green eyes, Adria and Bill were just watching each other, and will now both leave on the second night. But when he sees both of them the third morning, he realizes they must have been watching him, too. Adria and Bill have each been going through the same process, and they all leave on the third night. Using this sort of inductive reasoning, we can see that the pattern will repeat no matter how many prisoners you add. The key is the concept of common knowledge, coined by philosopher David Lewis. The new information was not contained in your statement itself, but in telling it to everyone simultaneously. Now, besides knowing at least one of them has green eyes, each prisoner also knows that everyone else is keeping track of all the green-eyed people they can see, and that each of them also knows this, and so on. What any given prisoner doesn't know is whether they themselves are one of the green-eyed people the others are keeping track of, until as many nights have passed as the number of prisoners on the island. Of course, you could have spared the prisoners 98 days on the island by telling them at least 99 of you have green eyes. But when mad dictators are involved, you're best off with a good head start.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
When I was in fourth grade, my teacher said to us one day, "There are as many even numbers as there are numbers." "Really?" I thought. "Well, yeah, there are infinitely many of both, so I suppose there are the same number of them. But on the other hand, the even numbers are only part of the whole numbers. All the odd numbers are left over, so there's got to be more whole numbers than even numbers, right?" To see what my teacher was getting at, let's first think about what it means for two sets to be the same size. What do I mean when I say I have the same number of fingers on my right hand as I do on my left hand? Of course, I have five fingers on each, but it's actually simpler than that. I don't have to count. I only need to see that I can match them up, one to one. In fact, we think that some ancient people, who spoke languages that didn't have words for numbers greater than three, used this sort of matching. For instance, if you let your sheep out of a pen to graze, you can keep track of how many went out by setting aside a stone for each one, and then putting those stones back one by one when the sheep return, so that you know if any are missing without really counting. As another example of matching being more fundamental than counting, if I'm speaking to a packed auditorium where every seat is taken and no one is standing, I know that there are the same number of chairs as people in the audience, even though I don't know how many there are of either. So what we really mean when we say that two sets are the same size is that the elements in those sets can be matched up one by one in some way. So my fourth grade teacher showed us the whole numbers laid out in a row, and below each we have its double. As you can see, the bottom row contains all the even numbers, and we have a one-to-one match. That is, there are as many even numbers as there are numbers. But what still bothers us is our distress over the fact that the even numbers seem to be only part of the whole numbers. But does this convince you that I don't have the same number of fingers on my right hand as I do on my left? Of course not. It doesn't matter if you try to match the elements in some way and it doesn't work. That doesn't convince us of anything. If you can find one way in which the elements of two sets do match up, then we say those two sets have the same number of elements. Can you make a list of all the fractions? This might be hard. There are a lot of fractions, and it's not obvious what to put first, or how to be sure all of them are on the list. Nevertheless, there is a very clever way that we can make a list of all the fractions. This was first done by Georg Cantor in the late 1800s. First, we put all the fractions into a grid. They're all there. For instance, you can find, say, 117 over 243 in the 117th row and 243rd column. Now, we make a list out of this by starting at the upper left and sweeping back and forth diagonally, skipping over any fraction, like 2 over 2, that represents the same number as one we've already picked. And so we get a list of all the fractions, which means we've created a one-to-one match between the whole numbers and the fractions, despite the fact that we thought maybe there ought to be more fractions. Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. You may know that not all real numbers, that is, not all the numbers on a number line, are fractions. The square root of 2 in pi, for instance. Any number like this is called irrational, not because it's crazy or anything, but because the fractions are ratios of whole numbers and so are called rationals, meaning the rest are non-rational, that is, irrational. Irrationals are represented by infinite non-repeating decimals. So, can we make a one-to-one match between the whole numbers and a set of all the decimals, both the rationals and the irrationals? That is, can we make a list of all the decimal numbers? Cantor showed that you can't. Not merely that we don't know how, but that it can't be done. Look, suppose you claim you have made a list of all the decimals. I'm going to show you that you didn't succeed by producing a decimal that's not on your list. I'll construct my decimal one place at a time. For the first decimal place of my number, I'll look at the first decimal place of your first number. If it's a 1, I'll make mine a 2. Otherwise, I'll make mine a 1. For the second place of my number, I'll look at the second place of your second number. Again, if yours is a 1, I'll make mine a 2. And otherwise, I'll make mine a 1. See how this is going? The decimal I produce can't be on your list. Why? Could it be, say, your 143rd number? No, because the 143rd place of my decimal is different from the 143rd place of your 143rd number. I made it that way. Your list is incomplete. It doesn't contain my decimal number. And no matter what list you give me, I can do the same thing and produce a decimal that's not on that list. So we're faced with this astounding conclusion. The decimal numbers cannot be put on a list. They represent a bigger infinity than the infinity of whole numbers. So even though we're familiar with only a few irrationals, like square root of 2 and pi, the infinity of irrationals is actually greater than the infinity of fractions. Someone once said that the rationals, the fractions, are like the stars in the night sky. The irrationals are like the blackness. Cantor also showed that for any infinite set, forming a new set made of all the subsets of the original set represents a bigger infinity than that original set. This means that once you have one infinity, you can always make a bigger one by making the set of all subsets of that first set, and then an even bigger one by making the set of all subsets of that one, and so on. And so, there are an infinite number of infinities of different sizes. If these ideas make you uncomfortable, you're not alone. Some of the greatest mathematicians of Cantor's day were very upset with this stuff. They tried to make these different infinities irrelevant, to make mathematics work without them somehow. Cantor was even vilified personally, and it got so bad for him that he suffered severe depression and spent the last half of his life in and out of mental institutions. But eventually, his ideas won out. Today, they are considered fundamental and magnificent. All research mathematicians accept these ideas, every college math major learns them, and I've explained them to you in a few minutes. Someday, perhaps, they'll be common knowledge. There's more. We just pointed out that the set of decimal numbers, that is, the real numbers, is a bigger infinity than a set of whole numbers. Cantor wondered whether there are infinities of different sizes between these two infinities. He didn't believe they were, but couldn't prove it. Cantor's conjecture became known as the continuum hypothesis. In 1900, the great mathematician David Hilbert listed the continuum hypothesis as the most important unsolved problem in mathematics. The 20th century saw a resolution of this problem, but in a completely unexpected, paradigm-shattering way. In the 1920s, Kurt Gödel showed that you could never prove that the continuum hypothesis is false. Then in the 1960s, Paul J. Kohn showed that you can never prove that the continuum hypothesis is true. Taken together, these results mean that there are unanswerable questions in mathematics, a very stunning conclusion. Mathematics is rightly considered the pinnacle of human reasoning, but we now know that even mathematics has its limitations. Still, mathematics has some truly amazing things for us to think about.
In the 1920s, the German mathematician David Hilbert devised a famous thought experiment to show us just how hard it is to wrap our minds around the concept of infinity. Imagine a hotel with an infinite number of rooms and a very hard-working night manager. One night, the infinite hotel is completely full, totally booked up with an infinite number of guests. A man walks into the hotel and asks for a room. Rather than turn him down, the night manager decides to make room for him. How? Easy. He asks the guest in room number one to move to room two, the guest in room two to move to room three, and so on. Every guest moves from room number n to room number n plus one. Since there are an infinite number of rooms, there is a new room for each existing guest. This leaves room one open for the new customer. The process can be repeated for any finite number of new guests. If, say, a tour bus unloads 40 new people looking for rooms, then every existing guest just moves from room number n to room number n plus 40, thus opening up the first 40 rooms. But now, an infinitely large bus with a countably infinite number of passengers pulls up to rent rooms. Countably infinite is the key. Now, the infinite bus of infinite passengers perplexes the night manager at first, but he realizes there's a way to place each new person. He asks the guest in room 1 to move to room 2. He then asks the guest in room 2 to move to room 4, the guest in room 3 to move to room 6, and so on. Each current guest moves from room number n to room number 2n, filling up only the infinite even-numbered rooms. By doing this, he has now emptied all of the infinitely many odd-numbered rooms, which are then taken by the people filing off the infinite bus. Everyone's happy, and the hotel's business is booming more than ever. Well, actually, it is booming exactly the same amount as ever, banking an infinite number of dollars a night. Word spreads about this incredible hotel. People pour in from far and wide. One night, the unthinkable happens. The night manager looks outside and sees an infinite line of infinitely large buses, each with a countably infinite number of passengers. What can he do? If he cannot find rooms for them, the hotel will lose out on an infinite amount of money, and he will surely lose his job. Luckily, he remembers that around the year 300 BCE, Euclid proved that there is an infinite quantity of prime numbers. So to accomplish this seemingly impossible task of finding infinite beds for infinite buses of infinite weary travelers, the night manager assigns every current guest to the first prime number, 2, raised to the power of their current room number. So, the current occupant of room number 7 goes to room number 2 to the 7th power, which is room 128. The night manager then takes the people on the first of the infinite buses and assigns them to the room number of the next prime, 3, raised to the power of their seat number on the bus. So, the person in seat number 7 on the first bus goes to room number 3 to the 7th power, or room number 2187. This continues for all of the first bus. The passengers on the second bus are assigned powers of the next prime, 5. The following bus, powers of 7. Each bus follows, powers of 11, powers of 13, powers of 17, etc. Since each of these numbers only has 1 and the natural number powers of their prime number base as factors, there are no overlapping room numbers. All the bus's passengers fan out into rooms using unique room assignment schemes based on unique prime numbers. In this way, The night manager can accommodate every passenger on every bus, although there will be many rooms that go unfilled, like room 6, since 6 is not a power of any prime number. Luckily, his bosses weren't very good in math, so his job is safe. The night manager's strategies are only possible because while the Infinite Hotel is certainly a logistical nightmare, it only deals with the lowest level of infinity, namely the countable infinity of the natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Georg Cantor called this level of infinity Aleph Zero. We use natural numbers for the room numbers as well as the seat numbers on the buses. If we were dealing with higher orders of infinity, such as that of the real numbers, these structured strategies would no longer be possible, as we have no way to systematically include every number. The real number infinite hotel has negative number rooms in the basement, fractional rooms, so the guy in room 1/2 always suspects he has less room than the guy in room 1, square root rooms like room radical 2, and room pi, where the guests expect free dessert. What self-respecting night manager would ever want to work there, even for an infinite salary? But over at Hilbert's Infinite Hotel, where there's never any vacancy and always room for more, the scenarios faced by the ever-diligent and maybe too hospitable night manager serve to remind us of just how hard it is for our relatively finite minds to grasp a concept as large as infinity. Maybe you can help tackle these problems after a good night's sleep, but honestly, we might need you to change rooms at 2 a.m.
You probably already know that everything is made up of little tiny things called atoms. You might even know that each atom is made up of even smaller particles called protons, neutrons, and electrons. And you've probably heard that atoms are small. But I'll bet you haven't ever thought about how small atoms really are. Well, the answer is that they are really, really, really small. So you ask, just how small are atoms? Well, to understand this, let's ask this question. How many atoms are in a grapefruit? Well, let's assume that the grapefruit is made up of only nitrogen atoms, which isn't at all true, but there are nitrogen atoms in a grapefruit. Well, to help you visualize this, let's blow up each of the atoms to the size of a blueberry. And then how big would the grapefruit have to be? It would have to be the same size of, well, actually, the Earth. That's crazy. You mean to say that if I filled the Earth with blueberries, I would have the same number of nitrogen atoms as a grapefruit? That's right. So how big's the atom? Well, it's really, 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 really small. And you know what? It gets even more crazy. Let's now look inside of each atom. That's the blueberry, right? What do you see there? In the center of the atom is something called the nucleus, which contains protons and neutrons. And on the outside, you'd see electrons. So how big is the nucleus? Well, if atoms are like blueberries in the Earth, how big would the nucleus be? You might remember the old pictures of the atom from your science class where you saw this tiny dot on the page with an arrow pointing to the nucleus. Well, those pictures, well, they're not drawn to scale, so they're kind of wrong. So how big is the nucleus? So if you popped open the blueberry and were searching for the nucleus, you know what? It would be invisible. It's too small to see. Okay, let's blow up the atom, the blueberry, to the size of a house. So imagine a ball that is as tall as a two-story house. Let's look for the nucleus in the center of the atom. And you know what? It would just barely be visible. So to get our minds wrapped around how big the nucleus is, we need to blow up the blueberry up to the size of a football stadium. So imagine a ball the size of a football stadium, and right smack dab in the center of the atom, you would find the nucleus. And you could see it. And it would be the size of a small marble. And there's more. If I haven't blown your mind by now, let's consider the atom some more. It contains protons, neutrons, and electrons. The protons and neutrons live inside of the nucleus and contain almost all of the mass of the atom. Way on the edge are the electrons. So if an atom is like a ball the size of a football stadium with a nucleus in the center and the electrons on the edge, what is in between the nucleus and the electrons? Surprisingly, the answer is empty space. That's right, empty. Between the nucleus and the electrons, there are vast regions of empty space. Now, technically, there are some electromagnetic fields, but in terms of stuff, matter, it is empty. Remember, this vast region of empty space is inside the blueberry, which is inside the Earth, which really are the atoms in the grapefruit. Okay, one more thing, if I can even get more bizarre. Since virtually all of the mass of an atom is in the nucleus, Now, there is some amount of mass in the electrons, but most of it is in the nucleus. How dense is the nucleus? Well, the answer is crazy. The density of a typical nucleus is 4 times 10 to the 17th kilogram per meter cubed. But that's hard to visualize. Okay, I'll put it in English units. 2.5 times 10 to the 16th pounds per cubic feet. Okay, that's still kind of hard to figure. Okay, here's what I want you to do. Make a box that is 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot. And let's go and grab all of the nuclei from a typical car. Now, cars on average weigh 2 tons. How many cars' nuclei would you have to put into the box to have your 1 foot box have the same density of a nucleus? Is it 1 car? 2? How about 100? Nope, nope, and nope. The answer is much bigger. It is 6.2 billion. That is almost equal to the number of people in the Earth. So if everyone on the Earth owned their own car, and they don't, and we put all of those cars into your box, that would be about the density of a nucleus. So I'm saying that if you took every car in the world and put it in your 1 foot box, it would have the density of 1 nucleus. Okay, let's review. The atom is really, really, really small. Think atoms in a grapefruit, like blueberries in the Earth. The nucleus is crazy small. Now look inside the blueberry and blow it up to the size of a football stadium, and now the nucleus is a marble in the middle. The atom is made up of vast regions of empty space. That's weird. The nucleus has a crazy high density. Think of putting all those cars in your 1 foot box. I think I'm tired.
The Firehall Arts Center's God and the Indian explores one of Canada's darkest chapters, the residential school system. Celebrated playwright Drew Hayden Taylor's Black Humor illuminates this heartbreaking story of a Cree woman who cannot escape her past, on from May 20th to 30th. See firehallartcenter.ca for details.
The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is one of a handful of ideas from quantum physics to expand into general pop culture. It says that you can never simultaneously know the exact position and the exact speed of an object, and shows up as a metaphor in everything from literary criticism to sports commentary. Uncertainty is often explained as a result of measurement, that the act of measuring an object's position changes its speed, or vice versa. The real origin is much deeper and more amazing. The uncertainty principle exists because everything in the universe behaves like both a particle and a wave at the same time. In quantum mechanics, the exact position and exact speed of an object have no meaning. To understand this, we need to think about what it means to behave like a particle or a wave. Particles, by definition, exist in a single place at any instant in time. We can represent this by a graph showing the probability of finding the object at a particular place, which looks like a spike, 100% at one specific position, and zero everywhere else. Waves, on the other hand, are disturbances spread out in space, like ripples covering the surface of a pond. We can clearly identify features of the wave pattern as a whole, most importantly, its wavelength, which is the distance between two neighboring peaks, or two neighboring valleys. But we can't assign it a single position. It has a good probability of being in lots of different places. Wavelength is essential for quantum physics because an object's wavelength is related to its momentum, mass times velocity. A fast-moving object has lots of momentum, which corresponds to a very short wavelength. A heavy object has lots of momentum even if it's not moving very fast, which again means a very short wavelength. This is why we don't notice the wave nature of everyday objects. If you toss a baseball up in the air, its wavelength is a billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a meter, far too tiny to ever detect. Small things, like atoms or electrons, though, can have wavelengths big enough to measure in physics experiments. So if we have a pure wave, we can measure its wavelength and thus its momentum, but it has no position. We can know a particle's position very well, but it doesn't have a wavelength, so we don't know its momentum. To get a particle with both position and momentum, we need to mix the two pictures to make a graph that has waves, but only in a small area. How can we do this? By combining waves with different wavelengths, which means giving our quantum object some possibility of having different momenta. When we add two waves, we find that there are places where the peaks line up, making a bigger wave, and other places where the peaks of one fill in the valleys of the other. The result has regions where we see waves separated by regions of nothing at all. If we add a third wave, the regions where the waves cancel out get bigger. A fourth, and they get bigger still, with the wavy regions becoming narrower. If we keep adding waves, we can make a wave packet with a clear wavelength in one small region. That's a quantum object, with both wave and particle nature. But to accomplish this, we had to lose certainty about both position and momentum. The position isn't restricted to a single point. There's a good probability of finding it within some range of the center of the wave packet. And we made the wave packet by adding lots of waves, which means there's some probability of finding it with a momentum corresponding to any one of those. Both position and momentum are now uncertain, and the uncertainties are connected. If you want to reduce the position uncertainty by making a smaller wave packet, you need to add more waves, which means a bigger momentum uncertainty. If you want to know the momentum better, you need a bigger wave packet, which means a bigger position uncertainty. That's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, first stated by German physicist Werner Heisenberg back in 1927. This uncertainty isn't a matter of measuring well or badly, but an inevitable result of combining particle and wave nature. The uncertainty principle isn't just a practical limit on measurement. It's a limit on what properties an object can have, built into the fundamental structure of the universe itself. How fast are you moving right now? That seems like an easy question. The first tempting answer is, I'm not moving. Upon further reflection, you realize that maybe the Earth's motion counts. So a second tempting answer is 19 miles per second around the Sun. But then you recall learning that the Sun moves around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and the Milky Way moves within the local group of galaxies, and the local group moves within the Virgo cluster, and the Virgo cluster moves within... How fast are you moving is not an easy question. When Mission Control tells astronauts how fast they're going, there is always an assumed standard of rest. At the start of the voyage, speeds are given relative to the launch pad. But later, when the launch pad is just one more arbitrary place down there on Earth's spinning surface, speeds are given relative to the idealized, non-spinning, pinpoint center of Earth. On their way to the moon, Apollo astronauts had a hard time answering the question, how fast are you moving? Speed away from Earth was one thing, and speed toward the moon was quite another. That's because the Earth and the moon move relative to one another. Ah, of course, speed is a relative quantity. When Captain Kirk asks Lieutenant Sulu if the Starship Enterprise has reached a speed of warp 7, Sulu should reply, relative to what, Captain? Such a sassy reply may get subordinate Starfleet officers in trouble, but it is the only good answer to the question, how fast are you moving? This is basic relativity talking. Not fancy Einsteinian relativity, but good, old-fashioned, and still correct Galilean relativity. Galileo seems to have been the first person to realize that there is no such thing as an absolute speed. Speeds are relative. This means that speeds only have meaning when they are referred to a reference frame. Presumably, that reference frame is itself at rest. But then we have to ask again, at rest relative to what? Because even the concept of rest has lost any hint of absolute meaning. Speed is relative, and rest is relative. Earth's speed is 19 miles per second relative to the Sun. The Enterprise's speed is warp 7 relative to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Your speed is 0 relative to your easy chair. But depending on where you sit, it is hundreds of miles per hour relative to Earth's center. When we furrow a brow and ask, but how fast is Earth really moving? We imagine spaceship Earth plowing through the ocean of space as it orbits the Sun. But space is not an ocean. It has no substance as water does. Space is not a thing. Space is nothing. Space is no thing. You can move between two points in space, say between Earth and Mars, but you can't move through space. There's nothing to move through. It's like trying to say how much a hole weighs. A hole weighs exactly nothing, because a hole is nothing. It's a void, and so is space. To move relative to nothing is meaningless. The concepts of speed and of rest have only relative meaning. They are absolutely meaningless. They mean something only with respect to arbitrarily chosen, artificial frames of reference. If someday you are buckled into your spaceship and you see from the side window, say, a space station whiz by at constant speed, there is no way to know which of you is really moving. Neither of you is really moving because there is no deep reality about constant speed. Constant speed in a straight line has only relative meaning, a kind of relative reality. Does this mean that all motion is relative? No. Some motions have only relative meaning, but some motions have absolute meaning, are absolutely real. For example, constant speed is relative, but change in speed is absolute. Calling something absolute in science means that arbitrary standards are not used in its measurement. It is unambiguously measurable. When your spaceship fires its engines, your change in speed is beyond doubt. You feel it in your stomach, and your ship's sensors can measure it. Outside your window, the passing space station may seem to be changing speed, but the beings inside the station will not feel it, and no sensors can measure it. You are really changing speed, and they really are not. There's something absolutely real about changes in speed. The same goes for rotation. If your spaceship is spinning, you can feel it, and your ship's sensors can measure it. The space station outside may seem to be going around you, but it is you who feels queasy, not the folks in the space station. You are really spinning, and they really are not. There's something absolutely real about rotation. So some motions are relative, and some are not. There is no deep reality about constant speed, but changes in speed are deeply real, and so are rotations. We have to be thoughtful in our analysis of everyday experience in order to identify what is deeply real. Since we can be fooled by perceptions as basic as speed, maybe every perception deserves careful scrutiny. This is what inspired Einstein to his incredible insights about the speed of light and forward time travel. Knowing how to identify what is deeply real is tough and important work. If a police officer ever pulls you over for speeding and asks, "Do you know how fast you were going?" an insightful, though perhaps unwise, reply would be, "Relative to what?" And then, as you sit in the back seat of the police car and feel it accelerate toward jail, you can add, "But some things are absolute."
What is at the center of the universe? It's an essential question that humans have been wondering about for centuries. But the journey toward an answer has been a strange one. If you wanted to know the answer to this question in 3rd century BCE Greece, you might look up at the night sky and trust what you see. That's what Aristotle, the guy to ask back then, did. He thought that since we're on Earth looking up, it must be the center, right? For him, the sphere of the world was made up of 4 elements: earth, water, air, and fire. These elements shifted around a nested set of solid crystalline spheres. Each of the wandering stars, the planets, had their own crystal sphere. The rest of the universe and all of its stars were on the last crystal sphere. If you watched the sky change over time, you could see that this idea worked fine at explaining the motion you saw. For centuries, this was central to how Europe and the Islamic world saw the universe. But in 1543, a guy named Copernicus proposed a different model. He believed that the sun was at the center of the universe. This radically new idea was hard for a lot of people to accept. After all, Aristotle's ideas made sense with what they could see, and they were pretty flattering to humans. But a series of subsequent discoveries made the sun-centric model hard to ignore. First, Johannes Kepler pointed out that orbits aren't perfect circles or spheres. Then Galileo's telescope caught Jupiter's moons orbiting around Jupiter, totally ignoring Earth. And then Newton proposed the theory of universal gravitation, demonstrating that all objects are pulling on each other. Eventually, we had to let go of the idea that we were at the center of the universe. Shortly after Copernicus in the 1580s, an Italian friar, Giordano Bruno, suggested the stars were suns that likely had their own planets, and that the universe was infinite. This idea didn't go over well. Bruno was burned at the stake for his radical suggestion. Centuries later, the philosopher René Descartes proposed that the universe was a series of whirlpools, which he called vortices, and that each star was at the center of a whirlpool. In time, we realized there were far more stars than Aristotle ever dreamed. As astronomers like William Herschel got more and more advanced telescopes, it became clear that our sun is actually one of many stars inside the Milky Way. And those smudges we see in the night sky? They're other galaxies just as vast as our Milky Way home. Maybe we're farther from the center than we ever realized. In the 1920s, astronomers studying the nebulae wanted to figure out how they were moving. Based on the Doppler effect, they expected to see blue shift for objects moving toward us and red shift for ones moving away. But all they saw was a red shift. Everything was moving away from us, fast. This observation is one of the pieces of evidence for what we now call the Big Bang Theory. According to this theory, all matter in the universe was once a singular, infinitely dense particle. In a sense, our piece of the universe was once at the center. But this theory eliminates the whole idea of a center, since there can't be a center to an infinite universe. The Big Bang wasn't just an explosion in space, it was an explosion of space. What each new discovery proves is that while our observations are limited, our ability to speculate and dream of what's out there isn't. What we think we know today can change tomorrow. As with many of the thinkers we just met, sometimes our wildest guesses lead to wonderful and humbling answers and propel us toward even more perplexing questions.
Did you know that the UBC Bookstore collects food for the AMS Food Bank? If you would like to contribute, please bring your non-perishable food items to the bookstore and drop them off in the box near the front cash area. For more information, check out ams.ubc.ca under Services.
The basic question is, does life exist beyond Earth? Scientists who are called astrobiologists are trying to find that out right now. Most astrobiologists are trying to figure out if there's microbial life on Mars, or in the ocean under the frozen surface of Jupiter's moon Europa, or in the liquid hydrocarbon lakes that we've found on Saturn's moon Titan. But one group of astrobiologists works on SETI. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And SETI researchers are trying to detect some evidence that intelligent creatures elsewhere have used technology to build a transmitter of some sort. But how likely is it that they will manage to find a signal? There are certainly no guarantees when it comes to SETI, but something called the Drake equation, named after Frank Drake, can help us organize our thinking about what might be required for a successful detection. If you've dealt with equations before, then you probably expect that there will be a solution to the equation, a right answer. The Drake equation, however, is different because there are so many unknowns. It has no right answer. As we learn more about our universe and our place within it, some of the unknowns get better known, and we can estimate an answer a bit better. But there won't be a definite answer to the Drake equation until SETI succeeds, or something else proves that Earthlings are the only intelligent species in our portion of the cosmos. In the meantime, it is really useful to consider the unknowns. The Drake equation attempts to estimate the number of technological civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy, we call that N, with whom we could make contact. And it's usually written as N equals R star multiplied by F sub P, multiplied by N sub E, multiplied by F sub L, multiplied by F sub I, multiplied by F sub C, and lastly, multiplied by capital L. All those factors multiplied together help to estimate the number of technological civilizations that we might be able to detect right now. Our star is the rate at which stars have been born in the Milky Way galaxy over the last few billion years. So it's a number that is stars per year. Our galaxy is 10 billion years old, and early in its history, stars formed at a different rate. All of the F factors are fractions. Each one must be less than or equal to 1. F sub P is the fraction of stars that have planets. N sub E is the average number of habitable planets in any planetary system. F sub L is the fraction of planets on which life actually begins, and F sub I is the fraction of all those life forms that develop intelligence. F sub C is the fraction of intelligent life that develops a civilization that decides to use some sort of transmitting technology. And finally, L, the longevity factor. On average, how many years do those transmitters continue to operate? Astronomers are now almost able to tell us what the product of the first three terms is. We're now finding exoplanets almost everywhere. The fractions dealing with life and intelligence and technological civilizations are ones that many, many experts ponder, but nobody knows for sure. So far, we only know of one place in the universe where life exists, and that's right here on Earth. In the next couple of decades, as we explore Mars and Europa and Titan, the discovery of any kind of life there will mean that life will be abundant in the Milky Way. Because if life originated twice within this one solar system, it means it was easy. And given similar conditions elsewhere, life will happen. So the number 2 is a very important number here. Scientists, including SETI researchers, often tend to make very crude estimates and acknowledge that there are very large uncertainties in these estimates in order to make progress. We think we know that R star and N sub E are both numbers that are closer to 10 than, say, to 1. And all the F factors are less than 1. Some of them may be much less than 1. But of all these unknowns, the biggest unknown is L. So perhaps the most useful version of the Drake equation is simply to say that N is approximately equal to L. The information in this equation is very clear. Unless L is large, N will be small. But, you know, you can also turn that around. If SETI succeeds in detecting a signal in the near future, after examining only a small portion of the stars in the Milky Way, then we learn that L, on average, must be large. Otherwise, we couldn't have succeeded so easily. A physicist named Philip Morrison summarized this by saying that SETI is the archaeology of the future. By this he meant that because the speed of light is finite, any signals detected from distant technologies will be telling us about their past by the time they reach us. But because L must be large for a successful detection, we also learn about our future, particularly that we can have a long future. We've developed technologies that can send signals into space and humans to the moon. But we've also developed technologies that can destroy the environment, that can wage war with weapons and biological terrorism. In the future, will our technology help stabilize our planet and our population, leading to a very long lifetime for us? Or will we destroy our world and its inhabitants after only a brief appearance on the cosmic stage? I encourage you to consider the unknowns in this equation. Why don't you make your own estimates for these unknowns and see what you come up with for N? Compare that with the estimates made by Frank Drake, Carl Sagan, other scientists, or your neighbors. Remember, there's no right answer. Not yet.
Somewhere out there in that vast universe, there must surely be countless other planets teeming with life. But why don't we see any evidence of it? Well, this is the famous question asked by Enrico Fermi in 1950. Where is everybody? Conspiracy theorists claim that UFOs are visiting all the time and the reports are just being covered up. But honestly, they aren't very convincing. But that leaves a real riddle. In the past year, the Kepler Space Observatory has found hundreds of planets just around nearby stars. And if you extrapolate that data, it looks like there could be 500 billion planets just in our own galaxy. If only 1 in 10,000 has conditions that might support a form of life, that's still 50 million possible life-harboring planets right here in the Milky Way. So here's the riddle. Our Earth didn't form until about 9 billion years after the Big Bang. Countless other planets in our galaxy should have formed earlier and given life a chance to get underway billions, or certainly many millions of years earlier than happened on Earth. If just a few of them had spawned intelligent life and started creating technologies, those technologies would have had millions of years to grow in complexity and power. On Earth, we've seen how dramatically technology can accelerate in just 100 years. In millions of years, an intelligent alien civilization could easily have spread out across the galaxy, perhaps creating giant energy-harvesting artifacts, or fleets of colonizing spaceships, or glorious works of art that fill the night sky. At the very least, you'd think they'd be revealing their presence, deliberately or otherwise, through electromagnetic signals of one kind or another. And yet we see no convincing evidence of any of it. Why? Well, there are numerous possible answers, some of them quite dark. Maybe a single superintelligent civilization has indeed taken over the galaxy and has imposed strict radio silence because it's paranoid of any potential competitors. It's just sitting there ready to obliterate anything that becomes a threat. Or maybe they're not that intelligent. Or perhaps the evolution of an intelligence capable of creating sophisticated technology is far rarer than we've assumed. After all, it's only happened once on Earth in 4 billion years. Maybe even that was incredibly lucky. Maybe we are the first such civilization in our galaxy. Or perhaps civilization carries with it the seeds of its own destruction through the inability to control the technologies it creates. But there are numerous more hopeful answers. I mean, for a start, we're not looking that hard, and we're spending a pitiful amount of money on it. Only a tiny fraction of the stars in our galaxy have really been looked at closely for signs of interesting signals. And perhaps we're not looking the right way. Maybe as civilizations develop, they quickly discover communication technologies far more sophisticated and useful than electromagnetic waves. Maybe all the action takes place inside the mysterious, recently discovered dark matter or dark energy that appear to account for most of the universe's mass. Or maybe we're looking at the wrong scale. Perhaps intelligent civilizations come to realize that life is ultimately just complex patterns of information interacting with each other in a beautiful way, and that that can happen more efficiently at a small scale. So just as on Earth, clunky stereo systems have shrunk to beautiful tiny iPods, maybe intelligent life itself, in order to reduce its footprint on the environment, has turned itself microscopic, so the solar system might be teeming with aliens and we're just not noticing them. Maybe the very ideas in our heads are a form of alien life. Well, okay, that's a crazy thought. The aliens made me say it. But it is cool that ideas do seem to have a life all of their own, and that they outlive their creators. Maybe biological life is just a passing phase. Well, within the next 15 years, we could start seeing real spectroscopic information from promising nearby planets that will reveal just how life-friendly they might be. And meanwhile, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is now releasing its data to the public so that millions of citizen scientists, maybe including you, can bring the power of the crowd to join the search. And here on Earth, amazing experiments are being done to try to create life from scratch, life that might be very different from the DNA forms we know. All of this will help us understand whether the universe is teeming with life, or whether indeed it's just us. Either answer, in its own way, is awe-inspiring. Because even if we are alone, the fact that we think and dream and ask these questions might yet turn out to be one of the most important facts about the universe. And I have one more piece of good news for you. The quest for knowledge and understanding never gets dull. It doesn't. It's actually the opposite. The more you know, the more amazing the world seems. And it's the crazy possibilities, the unanswered questions that pull us forward. So stay curious.
I hope you found today's show to be informative and fun. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.